Tape 2 of The Inner Art of Meditation. We join Jack Kornfield as he continues with a discussion of Buddhism's Eightfold Path.
Now, the third, fourth, and fifth steps of this Eightfold Path all have to do with relating meditation to how we live. As I said in the beginning, it's not just sitting on the cushion, because that's not of much value to us in Western life. But it's learning how to relate in a wakeful or conscious or compassionate way in the whole of our life. So these steps talk about what's traditionally called virtue or morality or ethics. If you find virtue or morality not a pleasant word, listen anyway. And I'll go through it and see if it makes sense to you. You don't have to believe anything here, but listen and see what resonates in your being and in your heart. So they are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Change that word. Conscious speech, conscious action, and conscious livelihood. Conscious speech says this. We spend a lot of time talking. Anybody notice? Most of it is done on automatic pilot. We do it, but we're not so conscious. We talk and we listen and so forth, yet we're not very awake. Conscious speech or right speech has several parts. First, it says, refrain from speaking in ways that harm other people. Don't lie. Don't gossip and undermine and backbite. Don't use words to create suffering. Not because you're not supposed to, but see what it's like to sit and meditate after a day of lying. Try it. It just doesn't work. If you want the heart to be at peace, or you want to come to some peace in the world, there's a meditative foundation, which is to let your words be in accord with what's true. Now, it's more than just not telling the untruth. It's really beginning to respect the power of speech. I had a friend who took a resolve in his practice to not gossip for a month. And by not gossiping, he wasn't even going to say positive things about someone who he knew when they weren't present. So this resolve was, if somebody's not there and I know them, I'm not going to talk about them. And he said it was extraordinary to discover what happened. 90% of his speech was eliminated. Words have a tremendous power. Do you know those few words that you said that you're really happy you said to someone that really made a difference? Or those other words that you said that you really wish you hadn't? It means beginning to respect speech as a part of our awakening. There's a story of an old Sufi master who comes into a village to heal a young child. And all the villagers crowded around. It was the headman's son. And he just said a few simple prayers and said, now he will be well. Well, someone who didn't believe in all this spiritual stuff stood up and said, what do you mean? He says a few words and the kid's supposed to get better. And everyone turns to look at this man and the master strides over to him. And he says, what do you mean to say that? You know nothing of this. You are an absolute, total, ignorant fool. This in front of all the villagers. Well, the man is enraged. He turns red. His body starts vibrating. He's about to strike out at the master. And the master says, see, if a word or two can turn you red and fill you with energy and anger, why shouldn't a few other words have the power to heal? Our words have great power. So if you wish to begin to cultivate a conscious or meditative life, you can also begin to work with conscious speech. The basic rules are to say that which is true and that which is useful or kind. Because you can say what's true in a really harmful way, kind of brutal honesty. Do you know what I mean? It's to couple speaking the truth with that which is helpful to others. And after a while, it starts to create the conditions in your heart and in your life and around you of living that kind of consciousness. In fact, if you want to practice a teaching or a practice to work with in modern times, working with right speech would be plenty. You could get enlightened from that. I mean it. To really listen every time you speak to see if it's connected with your heart and if it's true and kind. Right action is the same. It says to not harm through our actions. Traditionally, the precepts include not killing, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct. Let me talk about them a little bit, how they relate to the practice we're beginning. Not to kill. I don't know if you've become aware of it, but even small creatures don't seem to like it very much. And we get, in our culture, we get kind of insulated from the world. We have our heaters and our air conditioners and our cars and everything kind of protects us, and then one little creepy crawly and we have to do it away because it somehow it becomes a threat to our safety or something like that. And we have a cavalier attitude toward life. To not kill really means to begin to cultivate a reverence toward life. And to take care with it, that we share the earth with many beings. There was a cartoon in the New Yorker one autumn, showed two hunters and two deer on the hillside. The deer were talking one to another. One deer said, "Why don't they thin their own herds?" It's easy to make an excuse. But I haven't seen too many deer, and they do eat our garden some, but if there's too many something around here, it's not deer. And so it means to begin to cultivate a caring and a reverence to minimize your harm. Of course we live on other life. Life lives on life. You have to respect that, but to do it in a way that minimizes harm. Not to steal, it's the same thing. It doesn't make for a very good community life to have people stealing. It also makes for a very difficult time meditating. Again, try and sit and meditate after a day of stealing. It doesn't work very well because you're in conflict with something deeper in your own nature. Again, to not steal can be listened to on a deeper level. It means not to act in ways that are piggy. We share this earth, this environment, with so many beings, and to be sensitive to that, to the resources, to be respectful so that we live in harmony with it. To not kill, to not steal, to refrain from sexual misconduct. Again, it's very simple. Traditionally, the precept says, and they're called training precepts because you practice with them, I undertake to practice the training of refraining from sexual activity that causes harm to any other person, a second or third person. How many people in this room have made an idiot of themselves around sexuality? Don't raise your hands. We already know the answer, right? It's a very powerful force. It needs respect, and it too needs to be taken into our hearts. It too needs to be connected with our spiritual life if we want to awaken. So it says, pay attention to this powerful area and see that the acts on one hand can come out of greed and exploitation and attachment and controlling or manipulation, or sexuality can be associated with love, with intimacy, with communion, with caring for another person. And listen to where it comes from and begin to use that force as well to become conscious or awaken. The last part of this precept talks about alcohol and drugs, and I'll just say a few quick words about that. There are 20 million alcoholics in the U.S. and 10 million drug addicts, and 60 million people in their families or close to them who suffer from that. Then there are workaholics and sexaholics and gambleaholics and whatever. The power of addiction. How many people's lives have been touched in painful ways from addiction? Many, many people in this room, if I asked for hands to raise, I know that the majority of hands would go up. This precept says pay attention to the power of that and be really respectful of it don't use intoxicants in any way that lead to loss of awareness. I mean, it's hard enough to be aware, isn't it? So it's to be respectful of that and their powers. That's right speech, right action, right livelihood, which fits together with it in a very simple way, is to make your work also a part of your spiritual life. One Zen master friend of mine came after being a famous abbot in Korea and running a number of temples and so forth. He wanted to teach in America, and he decided to come by himself without all the pomp and circumstance. And he just got a job in a university town, tried to learn English. The job he got was in the laundromat. Didn't speak very good English. And so he was wearing his Zen robes, this little bald guy, and he'd go in and he'd mop the floors and put quarter in the change machine, fix things up and so forth. And gradually the students at the university would come in and see this funny-looking guy in the laundromat, and they'd ask, "Who are you?" And he'd say, "I Zen teacher." That's about all he could say. He invited them up to sit, and he showed them how to sit in Zen style in his apartment. And over a year or so working in the laundromat, gradually people came and got interested, and his first Zen center was founded. And then a couple more people came, and he had a second Zen center. He quit the laundromat, and now, like most of them, he drives quite a nice car and has centers all around and so forth. But anyway, what was wonderful was that he took whatever job there was, and he did it in the spirit of making that part of his practice. Right livelihood says, first, try to work in a way that doesn't harm other beings. Don't sell guns or drugs or other kinds of weapons. But more deeply than that, use the circumstances of work to awaken. Have you not been served by a waiter or waitress once in a while that's as if the Buddha themselves came and served you and then said some very wise thing and then disappeared? Remember those moments? You know? On the other hand, you've been served in the opposite way, I'm sure, too. Any kind of work, because it's a giving back to our world, we need this exchange, can be used to awaken. Even if it's very boring. Because, quite frankly, what could be more boring than sitting and watching your breath? Right? Whatever your work is, it can't be any more boring than what we just did. So it's not a question of that it's rote or that it's boring, but what is the spirit that you do it at? Could you work on an assembly line and do that with mindfulness so that you wake? Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Then the last three pieces of the Eightfold Path, to kind of summarize them, have to do with taking this practice inward. And they are right effort, right concentration, and right mindfulness. If you don't remember these things, they're all in a book and they're tapes and stuff, so you can just sort of let come into you whatever is useful tonight. Right effort is key in meditation or spiritual life, and the meaning is very simple. Right effort is the effort to be awake. It's not the effort to make things different or make yourself happy or high or this way or that way. It's the effort to come into the present and relate to what's here with wakefulness and kindness. To see what's here and bring some balance as well to it. The effort to be present. So in your meditation, all kinds of things will happen. You'll be bored, you'll be restless, you'll be happy, you'll be sad, you'll weep, you'll grieve sometimes, you'll find great joy and rapture coming. All of those are part of the meditation. The effort that's important to learn is the effort to be present with whatever's there and to do it with some sense of balance. Now the last two are right concentration and right mindfulness. And they really come together. That's what we started here, and we'll do again in a minute. Before you can really understand something, you have to be present with it. That's what concentration means. It means coming into the present and being steady, like a candle in a windless place. Or again, it's like training the puppy, bringing the puppy back again and again and again. Making ourselves quiet enough and steady enough so that we can feel what is going on in our body, or what is there in the heart, or how is the mind working. Kabir, the Indian poet, said, "I don't know what kind of a god we're talking about. The caller chants in a loud voice at dusk. Does he think God is deaf? Don't you know that God hears the ringing of the anklets on the feet of an insect as it walks?" And so part of what this concentration means is this art of listening. Meditation is the development of an inner stillness or steadiness which can begin to listen to ourselves in ways that we've kept too busy to do before. It's not going to come easily, I promise you. When you first start to sit, you'll be all over the map. But it's an art, just like you could learn to paint oil colors, or just like you could learn any other great art, to play beautiful music. Over time, it's an inner art, and it's wonderful. The last step is right mindfulness, and that's the key to all of this practice. Mindfulness means being here in the present with what is here. And that's the essence of the Buddha's awakening, of the practice that we'll do. Mindfulness means being present without trying to change it, seeing it and opening to what's present with understanding, with kindness, with clarity. That's not an easy thing. Usually, when we're relating to what's here, what we relate from is how we would like to fix it. Project mentality. You'll see it in meditation. Do you know what I mean? We spend our whole lives trying to fix things. And meditation is stopping the projects and the fixing and just coming into relation to what's here. Now, I'll say one more thing about mindfulness and then I'll be done this Eightfold Path. One of the reasons that makes mindfulness worthwhile is if any of you are interested in love. And I suspect some of you are, most of us, in fact, that's the deepest thing that we desire. There's only one place that we can love. We can't love in the past. That's called a memory. It might be a good memory, but it's just a memory. We can't love in the future. That's called a fantasy. The only place where we can love, be loved and love, is in the present. To love another person, the rain, the trees, the earth around us, the world that we're in. And to touch love, to love and be loved, requires a living in the reality of the present. So these are the traditional steps or contexts within which meditation is taught, that one realizes that speech and action, taking care with one's life, provide the ground for the development of concentration and calm and an opening of the body and mind. I was called by a friend to go to the hospital at the UC Med Center some years ago. Her brother, it seemed, was dying of cancer. So I went in to see him, and he was a reasonably young guy. He was 38. He had a family and a big business. He was a contractor that did development. Quite successful. He had a big ranch and a sailboat and everything. He'd done a little bit of Zen in the 60s and a little LSD and kind of messed around with that stuff and then just dropped it and went into business and got fully into it. Drove along one day down the road and fainted for a little bit at the wheel of his car, and after medical checkup determined he had a brain tumor. So he went in the hospital and they did CAT scans and biopsies, and they came in that day and said, "We're sorry to tell you, but you have melanoma, which is a rapid growing kind of cancer. You have a tumor in your brain. If we don't do surgery, you probably have 6 weeks to live at most, 4 to 6 weeks. If we do surgery, the tumor is in the speech and understanding area of your brain. And so afterward, you may no longer be able to speak or read or write or understand any language. We'd like to operate tomorrow morning. Please let us know." So I went in to see this person. person. And as you can imagine, he was in a really extraordinary state. And it was even though it was very frightening for him in some ways, it was also a privilege to be with him. And we talked, and the only thing he wanted to talk about was his spiritual life. Forget what he had built and done and so forth. He went back to draw on those few things that he had learned in meditation. Because when you come to big changes in your life, they don't take your American Express traveler's checks. When you go to the change booth for the big changes, the only currency that's of any value is the currency of the heart. And it's really what you've learned in how to let go and in your compassion and your wisdom and your strength of being. So we talked about that a long time. That's all he wanted to talk about, what it meant to be alive and die. Both. And then he looked at me and he said, you know, I take a drink of water, the San Francisco City water, and it tastes so sweet, so good. Or I look out on my windowsill and there are these pigeons on UC Medical Center, like fifth floor or something, and they fly off. And he said, it's so beautiful to see a bird just take off and fly in the air. He said, maybe I've said enough in my life. Maybe I should just listen. And so he elected to have the surgery. He had a famous surgeon, and after about 18 hours in surgery, he came to the recovery room the next day, and his sister went in to see him in the morning, and he looked up at her, and he said, good morning. And somehow they'd been able to take enough of the tumor out without disturbing the brain cells in speech center so that he could still speak. He lived for 8 years after that. He's died since this time in an entirely different way. He just completely changed his life. He still did some work. He didn't throw his business away. But he lived from such a deeper place. And he became a counselor for many people, people who were sick, people who were grieving and going through difficulty. And he did it with such love and such understanding because he came in that experience to really deeply appreciate being awake and living his life. And that's what meditation offers. Questions before our next sitting? We'll sit in a minute, but please.
I get a little confused on these precepts of choosing a right behavior and not interfering, you know, just observing.
Yes. In the sitting that we're doing, we are cultivating a non-choosing awareness that just sees what's present. Out of that, out of coming to bring the breath and body and mind together and being more settled in the present, then comes the possibility of making wiser choices or making choices that come because we listen more deeply to their impact in us and on others so that we respond rather than react. So the first step, and a lot of what meditation is about, is listening. And then out of that listening comes the possibility, since we will act, we do all the time, of acting in a more attentive or caring or wise way. Okay, let's sit again. 15 minutes. So find your posture again, or some posture. And at home you can experiment with cushions and chairs, whatever way you like. Let your eyes close gently when you're ready. And we'll just stay with this first basic exercise of bringing the mind and the body and the heart all together here by using the ever-present movement of breath. You can use it here, you can use it when you're running and jogging, when you're driving. Your breath is always with you. With your eyes closed, then come into the body and be aware of what you notice. If there's any obvious tension, try to soften or relax that. So that you're both relaxed and alert. Let your shoulders be soft and your hands relax. Let the eyes and the face be soft. Let the belly be easy, soft. and feel the rhythm of the breath as it shows itself in your body. Let the breath bring the mind and body and heart together, coming back to it over and over when you wander away. Feel the breath in whatever place it shows itself most clearly. For some of you, it may be in the nose, the upper lip, or the back of the throat. For others, the breath may be felt more in the chest or belly. Notice wherever you are observing it, that at that place there's a beginning and an end of the in-breath, whether it's at the nose or the belly. Certain sensations, and a beginning and end of the out-breath. Feel the whole movement of the breath, and use the breath to calm and steady the mind. Can you notice when the breath just begins? Notice if there's a space between breaths and let that be okay. If there is, then just feel your body sitting here, receiving the next breath when it comes. If the breath gets soft, try to let your attention become very soft as well. A soft, receptive awareness to feel the littlest movement of the breath, settled and relaxing into the breath. when you notice the mind has wandered away, as soon as you're aware, come back again to the next breath. Feel what that breath is like, back to this breath. One more minute. Be with the breath just as it is. Was that any easier the second time, or harder?
Harder.
Harder for some? All right. If you want to work with the meditation, and if you want to learn it, what will be critical for these 5 weeks is that you work with a daily practice. If you come here and sit for 20 minutes or 15 minutes twice in an evening, and get a little bit of entertainment, and then don't practice, it'll be like going to a piano lesson and then going home and never practicing, then coming to another lesson. You'll never learn to play piano. So the one thing that's critical in finding some value out of this is to establish for this time a daily practice. Here are a few things to keep in mind. A regular time. It can be morning if you like, or evening. It varies person to person. Some people are more awake at night and like to do that. Others want to start their day by centering and calming. So find a regular time, minimally 15 or 20 minutes to start with. Okay? You can build up from there, but that's a place to start. It helps to have a regular place to sit. To put your cushion in the corner of a room, or to have a chair, or establish some place that is your quiet place, that is your sitting place.